Hello, and welcome to this rather special episode of Assassinations Podcast. This is the 100th episode of the show. Yes, that's right. There have been 100 installments of murder, conspiracy, intrigue, and cover-up since the show launched in the spring of 2018. I think we've covered some fascinating cases, from our very first episode on Rasputin, the Mad Monk, through spies such as Lawrence of Arabia, journalists like Anna Politkovskaya, politicians Robert Kennedy and Harvey Milk, and downright dodgy characters like Robert Maxwell and Ashraf Marwan. Throughout history, from Julius Caesar to Princess Diana, we have looked at assassinations that have been confirmed, attempted, or alleged. Some of the stories have been a little bit more light-hearted, at least given the inherent seriousness of the topic, such as our look at the crazy court of the Emperor Caligula. But inevitably, many of the cases, especially the more recent ones, have been both sad and troubling. I think especially of the murder of Martin Luther King, a brilliant man cut down in his prime. I've had the opportunity these last 3 years to work with and speak to some fascinating people. I thoroughly enjoyed our collaboration with A History of Italy podcast, where we delved into the debauchery of Vatican life in the days of the Borgias. And I've spoken with authors and historians who have given us creative and fascinating glimpses into the darker side of history. Best of all, I've been working with producer Lindsay Morse and musician Graham Ronald. Thanks, guys. And thanks to you, the listeners. Whether you've been with us from the start, you've joined along the way, or hey, if this is the very first time you're tuning in, I appreciate each and every one of you. Special love must go, of course, to our dear Patreon supporters. Y'all help to keep us trucking. Your commitment of a monthly donation is super appreciated. Patreon support helps to make this show possible, so really, we all owe them a big thank you. So, with all that said, shall we get on with our 100th episode? How on earth have we managed to go for the last 3 years without talking about the Assassins? The medieval Islamic sect, originating in the mountains of Persia, whose elite warriors struck fear into foes that often outnumbered them many times over. They were, if you will, the OGs of covert ops. They were so adept at the use of deception and disguise to kill their foes that they actually gave us the name Assassin, taken from what they called themselves Assassion, meaning people who are faithful. They were the warrior caste of the Nizari Ismaili sect, a Shia political entity that existed in modern-day Iran and Syria. But, as we shall find out, they were more than just fanatical killers, especially under their greatest leader, Rashid ad-Din Sinan. The Nizari state used political expediency and psychological warfare to protect itself from powerful enemies, while promoting art and learning in their realm. So, let's go way, way back, shall we? Let's weave a fictional story, though based on facts, the better to tarry a while in the Eastern Mediterranean and Levant during the Middle Ages, where wars of religion and conflicts between powerful men wreak havoc. But before we do, we're going to meet someone else. A familiar figure from history. A man who wrote about the Order of Assassins in his famous travelogue, a book full of historical detail, thrilling adventures, and maybe just a pinch of exaggeration. Even though he never encountered them himself, this medieval writer introduced many people in Europe to Rashid Sinan and his assassins. We join this weary traveller as he steps from a bustling street into a small bookstore in Constantinople, capital of the waning Byzantine Empire, in the year 1295 AD. Welcome to Assassinations Podcast, where we delve into some of history's most notorious political killings and explore the mysteries and conspiracies that surround them. Time and again, assassins have wielded the blade, the poison vial, the bullet, and the bomb to shape the course of history. I'm your host, Neil Cooper, and in this podcast, I'm going to investigate the lives and deaths of some of history's most colourful characters.
Is the gentleman looking for anything in particular?
The bookseller sizes up the man perusing a shelf of Greek Orthodox ecclesiastical tomes. The customer is well-dressed, and his servant stands outside the shop. A prosperous merchant, the bookseller assumes, literate, but probably not much of a scholar. The language of the merchant is all about money. He probably just wants to bring home a rare book to show off to his merchant friends.
I have rare texts written by the church fathers, if you are a religious scholar.
No, just browsing. Though, I do wonder, have you any works about travel?
Travel, sir?
Yes, you know, records or stories of one's travels.
Well, sir, I'm not really sure what that would mean.
Has anyone ever written an account of journeying through their country or the wider world?
Ah, such as the Odyssey.
No, that's not really what I have in mind. I mean, now, in real life, not allegorical sojourns, but actual travel. For example, that of a Venetian merchant.
Of a merchant?
The bookseller laughs. Why, that is an amusing notion. Who on earth would want to read the day-to-day drudgery of a merchant? How he traded wool from the Alps for wine from Dalmatia and sold that for a few nomismi on the docks? Hardly what one might call riveting or improving literature. A merchant's life can be interesting. We see the world, we encounter and must gain an understanding of other people and their way of life, their different philosophies.
I did not mean to offend, sir, the bookseller smirks. I did not realise that I was in the presence of a philosopher.
The traveller picks up a thick book bound in soft kid skin with gilded edging to its fine parchment pages. He opens it.
I don't suppose you speak Persian. That is a history of the Crusades, a rather expensive artefact, not for the everyday reader, but a very impressive book to display in one's home, even if one doesn't know what's written inside.
I do speak a little Persian, as a matter of fact. Not so brilliantly as you, no doubt, I learned the language during my mercantile activities, but you must have learned it while sitting in this little shop. This little shop, sir, is the treasury of my life's work. The books you see around you are exquisite jewels, drawn from the most profound minds in the most respected seats of learning of Europe and the Holy Lands. The works you see here, committed to the page by clerics of supreme skill, have been sourced from across the known world. Only the finest books are to be found here, in my little shop. Through these pages, I have seen the world. Well, yes, but I've actually seen it. Horizons further than those seen by any other man, alive or dead. This is a joke, and not a very good one. You are the new Odysseus? Not at all. I've seen far more of the world than that old Greek, and things at least as remarkable. Have you been to Basra, city of 1,000 scholars, where the great Euphrates and Tigris rivers meet? I purchased a rare, indeed unique, book of Arab poetry from an unscrupulous cleric who fled his position at the great library there. The visitor shakes his head. I have not been to Basra, no. Well, have you been to Cairo, then? Have you stood in awe before the great pyramids? I purchased a pristine Ptolemaic papyrus scroll from the runaway son of a Bedouin chieftain. I must confess, no, I have not been to Egypt either. The bookseller rolls his eyes.
Let's try something easier then, shall we? Have you even been to Rome?
No, though I have reason enough to do pilgrimage to the Eternal City.
Some traveller you are.
Oh, no, it's just that you mentioned a few of those rare places I haven't yet been. The bookseller smirks.
I see. You've come all the way from Venice to the far, far off city of Constantinople, and now you think yourself a citizen of the world. Why, any galley slave could claim to be so well travelled.
I have seen somewhat more of the world than that, good sir.
Pray tell, I possess books that can transport me from Munich to Mecca and from Cordoba to Kiev. This shop is a repository of such treasures as a bumpkin peddler could never fathom. If you have travelled even a mile further afield than the books on these shelves, then I shall eat my hat.
Your hat, sir?
My hat, sir.
I should not want that, for it is a very fine cap of velvet, and it does such a marvellous job covering your big head. You see, I have travelled so far afield and seen such things that you could never read about, such sights as you could never even imagine. So, to watch a man eat his hat, I should think a perfectly unremarkable sight. But if you really do wish to wager, then I would offer you these terms. Let me prove to you that I am the most well-travelled man in the world. If I succeed, then I should like to take any book from your collection. But should I fail, then I will eat your hat and pay you for it.
Enough of your blabber, Venetian. If eating my hat silences your boastful mouth, it might serve you as a valuable lesson in humility. If you can prove the ridiculous things that you say, then you may take your pick of any book from my shop. Why, I have never made a safer bet in my life.
Marco Polo smiles. From a leather purse tied to his belt, he pulls a silver coin with a square hole in the middle. What's that? A gypsy's good luck charm?
Look more closely. Can you read Chinese?
Chinese?
Indeed. This is a coin from Cathay, from the Royal Mint of Beijing. Here it reads, struck in the name of His Lordship Kublai Khan. The shop owner peers at it.
That could say anything. It's just lines. Squiggles.
To a barbarian, certainly it might seem so. My apologies. That is how the scribes of Cathay view ignorant outsiders. Barbarians. They welcomed me, though, seeing in me the fine qualities of wisdom, patience, and diplomacy. But fret not, bookseller, I do not judge you harshly for your illiteracy in the Chinese language. Why, even the late, great Khan Kublai could not read or write. And why would he have taken the time to learn to do so, for he had at his command the wisest men of the world? Philosophers, mathematicians, astronomers, alchemists, wizards, and priests of every religion. He would ask any question, and in an instant he had his choice of answers provided by men with even bigger heads than yours.
Pah! Stuff and nonsense, Kublai Khan.
Indeed. Now, which book am I going to take?
Now wait here, you think you've proven anything just because you've shown me a little coin?
Somehow, I did not think that would persuade you, no. So, how about this?
Marco Polo reaches into a discreet pocket inside his cape. From it, he pulls a narrow tube. It is of highly polished wood, black as onyx and almost as hard. He unscrews a little silver cap on one end and delicately pulls out a scroll. He makes space on the bookseller's table and carefully opens it out.
Behold!
Behold what?
What you see, man! Behold this parchment, which bears a sutra written by Jain monks in a great temple in Kerala. The king of that land presented me with this gift when I was passing through his realm.
What is this silliness? Kerala? Jains? Are you making up words, you scoundrel?
For shame! Would you question my honour? I tell you true, I met the king of Kerala, which is a fabulously wealthy land in the very hottest region of the Indies. The king's body was adorned with golden rings and bracelets set with rubies, sapphires and pearls, though he wore not a stitch of clothing beside a simple loincloth. And as for the Jains, they are a sect of most remarkable holy men who are always quite naked, who happily sleep on the ground amidst spiders and scorpions, and who refuse to kill any living thing, not even a flea. They live to a ripe old age, subsisting only on root vegetables and water, and they are most devout in the veneration of their pagan gods.
These are the tallest tales I have ever heard, the bookseller exclaims.
And this scrap of paper with some indecipherable writings is proof of nothing.
Yes, well, I thought you might say that too, though heaven knows I speak in good sooth. Nonetheless, I see that you are in need of further evidence, of proof without doubt.
Go on then.
I am returning to my native Venice, whose beauty I have missed for many a long year. I bring back with me many stories, many experiences, from my travels throughout all the realm of Khan Kublai and across most of the other notable kingdoms of the Orient. I have sojourned through Viet, Sumatra, Burma, the Isle of Ceylon, and the mountains of Persia. I have seen unicorns, cities of gold, men with tails, and princesses of such beauty and grace that would put the finest maidens of Europe to shame. But as to goods, I only have a few, it is true. My party and I were robbed by bandits across the Black Sea in Trabzon. However, by good fortune, those brigands were hasty, taking only what they saw, and not what was hidden. At that, Marco Polo snaps his fingers. His manservant rushes into the shop and stands to attention at his side. The servant is a Mongol, stockily built, with black hair and a wispy moustache. His master addresses him in a language that the bookseller cannot understand. The servant nods earnestly at the command and unbuttons his tunic and the shirt underneath. A wallet is attached to a belt that goes around his chest. From the wallet, the servant retrieves a thin, oblong tablet of solid gold. He hands it to his master. The bookseller gazes in awe at the gleaming precious metal. Marco Polo places the object on the table with a satisfying thud. The gold is engraved with a dragon and two lines of Mongolian script. This is a pass issued to me by the great Khan himself. I served as his emissary for 17 years, you see. Perhaps you have heard of such treasures as this, worth more than the gold itself or the words inscribed upon it. To possess this tablet is to hold one of the most precious objects in all of Asia. By the mere display of this token, I could travel freely and without fear across the realm of the Khan, and throughout the lands of all those who honour him and tremble when they consider the might of his armies. The bookseller is dumbstruck.
Well, I suppose, yes, I have heard of such things, but...
He glances at the stony-faced Mongol servant.
It could be a forgery, I suppose.
A forgery? I've never heard of such a thing. Look at the perfection of workmanship on this, stamped at the Imperial Mint in Chengdu. Who would dare forge the name of the Great Khan? Any man caught doing so would be torn limb from limb by four teams of horses and his family sold as slaves. Of course, you do not read the Mongolian language, just as you are unable to read Chinese or Sanskrit. Some book dealer you are. So I shall translate it. Ahem. By the power of eternal heaven, this is an order of the Great Khan. Whoever does not show respect to the bearer will be guilty of an offence. Now, will you show respect? Will you keep your word, fulfil your end of our bargain? Marco Polo smiles, as though butter wouldn't melt in his mouth.
The book dealer looks lost. You have played a trick on me.
No, we made a deal. We agreed. And we both know that it does a man ill to break his word. At this, the stout and silent Mongol returns the golden tablet to the wallet, fastens his shirt and tunic, and then slowly cracks his knuckles.
Yes, well, perhaps. Is there a particular book you had in mind?
I have a very interesting and edifying treatise on the debate between Cyril of Alexandria and the Nestorians. No, I don't think so. In fact, that Persian history of the Third Crusade rather caught my eye.
Well, I don't think so, but...
But I will leave you something, as a show of good grace, as I am sure that is a very expensive book. The Sanskrit Sutra is yours. And so your horizons, he looks around the little shop, have thusly been broadened.
Marco Polo takes the book and exits the shop with his servant. They disappear into the thronged street of the great metropolis of Constantinople. That night, as he drinks a glass of wine in rented rooms overlooking the Hagia Sophia, he reads his cunningly acquired new prize. The strange story of the Sultan, the King, and the Old Man of the Mountains. Rashid ad-Din Sinan was the greatest of the Nizaris of Syria. Born into a good family in Basra, Allah inclined his mind to learning from childhood. He could recite the Holy Quran before he had hair on his chin, and he could debate wise old scholars before he reached his 20th year. Strong and skilled in the arts of war, he nonetheless chose to work as a teacher, that he should share the wisdom Allah had bestowed upon him with the other young men of Basra. All the elders of the city, and all of the scholars and merchants who went there each year, marvelled at the prodigy, saying, "This Rashid, whose beard is not yet full, is eloquent in expression, powerful in argument, sharp of vision, swift in improvisation, and unmatched in the principles of interpretation, poetry, and astronomy. Truly, Allah has blessed him and his family. Indeed, all Basra is blessed by such a son." And yet, God called Sinan further afield. He bid farewell to his mother and father, to his students and friends, and travelled many, many miles to the mountain fortress of Alamut to study with an Ismaili imam who resided there. Alamut is a fortress built upon a steep hill at the head of a valley in the high mountains of Persia. The valley is beautiful and abundant in excellent fruit trees, fragrant flowers, fresh water, and fat livestock. The fortress that guards it is impregnable. No uninvited man has ever entered it. Within its walls, palaces of various sizes and forms were erected in the different parts of the grounds, ornamented with works in gold, with paintings, and with furnishings of rich silks. By means of small conduits in these buildings, streams of wine, milk, honey, and pure water were seen to flow in every direction. It is said that the inhabitants of these palaces were dainty and beautiful damsels, accomplished singers and musicians all, practiced in the art of dancing, and trained in the ways of love. They were seen continually sporting and amusing themselves in the garden and its pavilions. The reason that the imam had furnished this heaven on earth was this: that Muhammad had promised to those who should obey his will the enjoyments of paradise, where every species of sensual gratification should be found, in the society of beautiful nymphs. Therefore, the old imam wanted it understood by his followers that he was also a prophet and the compeer of Muhammad, and had equal power of admitting to paradise such as he chose to favour. In order that no one might find his way into this delicious haven without his permission, he caused the only opening to the fortress to be by secret passage. The heartiest, bravest, most warlike lads of the valley were selected by the imam's spies, who brought them to the secret entrance and thereby up to the fortress with its pleasure gardens. There, the youths were fed milk, honey, fruits, choice meats and cakes, and the purest water. They were entertained by the beautiful maidens,
a dozen to each lad. The old imam would appear each day to hold forth on the subject of the paradise announced by the prophet, and of his own power of granting admission to it. At certain times he caused opium to be administered to one of the youths. When he was unconscious, the imam had him conveyed from the pleasure garden to some dingy barracks. When the youth awoke, he would be distraught, because he believed he had been cast out of heaven. Just as his poor young heart was about to break, the imam would appear. The young man would fall at his feet and beg the imam to readmit him to paradise. As a grandfather, so the imam would lift up the face of the young man, wipe away his tears, and tell the youth that, yes, he would re-enter paradise, but only if he obeyed every command of the imam. By this method of instruction, the imam made of these rustic lads the most devoted soldiers. To regain paradise, they would do anything. Death meant nothing to them, for the imam told them that if they died in his service, then their re-entry to the garden of sensual delights was guaranteed. During his days in the fortress of Alamut, Sinan became wise in the ways of this peculiar sect. So wise, in fact, that he was chosen to take over as its leader following the death of the old imam. Sinan was selected due to his energetic character as much as his great learning and eloquence. For that sect, known to some as the Nizaris and to other as the Order of the Assassins, are as deft with swordsmanship as they are with debating, with their daggers kept as sharp as their pens. In the early days of Sinan's rule, the people of his Syrian lands faced many enemies. Long years of war had decimated the villages and denuded the once fertile valleys. Of particular menace were the Christians. An order of their knights, called the Templars, had attacked and seized the territories once held by the Assassins, forcing the poor Muslim people to pay heavy taxes. A skillful strategist and a master diplomat, Sinan rallied his people, putting a stop to petty squabbles within his own ranks, and roused them to fight back against the infidels who had invaded their lands. Alas for Sinan, trouble beset him from both sides. Just as he was preparing to fight the Christian knights, his realm was threatened by the army of the mighty Saladin, Sultan of Egypt. As the hare is chased by the eagle and the wolf, so were Sinan and his Nizari people caught between two formidable foes. As he lay awake pondering his fate one night, Allah sent one of his angels to bear a message to Sinan. The angel spake thusly, "Thou art a faithful servant of God and a shepherd to his flock in the mountains of Syria. All things are known to God. He has numbered the days of your life. But those days have not yet run their course. Remember the words of Imam Ali, son-in-law of the Prophet. Give your enemy 1,000 chances to become your friend, but do not give your friend 1 chance to become your enemy. Who is your enemy, Rashid? And who is your friend?" At that, the angel vanished. This message perplexed Sinan. Surely both the Christian knights and the Sultan of Egypt were his enemies. Both threatened his people. But perhaps Saladin ought to be his friend. After all, though he was a most bloodthirsty tyrant, he was yet faithful to the one true God. The Christians, on the other hand, ought to be his enemies, as they followed a corrupted and confused religion that misunderstood the laws of Allah in a thousand obscene ways. After much thought, Sinan decided upon a course of action, based on his understanding of the angel's message. "Does it not say in the Holy Quran," Sinan told his followers, "if the enemy inclines to peace, then incline to it also, and rely upon Allah?" His fighting men thought this very wise and prudent, and heartily agreed that Sinan should enter negotiations with both the Christians and Saladin. Whichever proved to be a friend would be a friend. Whichever betrayed themselves as an enemy would face the wrath of the assassins. At first, it seemed that Saladin would be the foe. He was marching against Aleppo, consolidating his hold over Syria and doing much damage to Sinan's possessions. However, before he completed his campaign, the Sultan suddenly lifted the siege of two Nizari forts. A rumour quickly spread that Saladin did this because he had twice escaped the deadly blades of the assassins, and he did not like his chances should the feared killers sneak into his camp a third time. According to one version, one night, Saladin's guards noticed a spark glowing on a hillside near their encampment. They raised the alarm, and their leader awoke from his sleep to find a figure leaving his tent. Looking around, he saw that the lamps in his tent had been moved. By the side of the bed was laid a loaf of bread, still hot from the oven, and stabbed into that loaf was a dagger. Saladin gave a loud cry, exclaiming that Sinan himself was the figure that left the tent. The Sultan told his captains to ride out to negotiate a truce with the assassins, thereby to protect his life from Sinan, who the Sultan had come to believe possessed the unholy powers of disguise. Indeed, that the leader of the assassins might even be a jinn. Saladin declared loftily, "This Sinan is a crafty warrior and skilled in winning men's hearts. Allah has saved me from his evil, and Sinan shall be saved by me." When asked by one of his followers why he had not killed the Sultan when he had the chance, Sinan merely replied by quoting the proverb, "It is preferable that all snakes found in houses should be warned. I urge you, O snake, not to appear before us or harm us." By and by, the mighty Saladin came to an agreement with Sinan. Calculating that the assassins might make better friends than foes, he sought to align himself with them. Then, together, they might turn upon the infidels. To wit, Sinan ordered his soldiers to slip into the camp of the Christian prince whose name was Conrad. This prince, who was the leader of all the Christians in those parts, was a thorn in the side of Saladin. Conrad twice thwarted the Sultan's attempts to capture the city of Tyre, and acted with such bravery, cunning, and ruthlessness that even the most battle-hardened of the Egyptian generals were amazed. During the second siege of Tyre, Saladin attacked the city by land and by sea. Hoping to end the siege quickly and with a minimum of bloodshed, Saladin presented before the walls of Tyre Conrad's aged father, who had been captured during an earlier battle. The Sultan offered to release the old man and, moreover, to bestow generous gifts upon Conrad if he surrendered the city.
the old man called up to the battlements, telling his son to stand firm, even when the Egyptians abused and threatened to kill him. Standing on the ramparts, Conrad declared that his father had lived a long life already, and the Sultan could do with him as he willed.
The Egyptians could not believe their ears that any son could be so callous about the fate of his father.
Thinking perhaps that Conrad failed to understand that they would kill the old man, or perhaps that they had misunderstood his reply, they cried out again that Conrad should forfeit the city, at which the Sultan would release his father and give many generous gifts. At this, Conrad snatched a crossbow from one of his men and took aim at his own father's breast. Though he had led his men through years of brutal warfare, Saladin was shocked and declared, "This Conrad has a heathen heart and a nature more cruel than any infidel I have ever fought. If this Christian cares not for his father, but would rather murder him than parley with me, then it behooves me, as the leader of the faithful, to show mercy upon this poor old man." At which the dread Sultan freed his prisoner, who was later reunited with his Christian brethren. That night, Conrad sent his forces to capture the Egyptian galleys besieging Tyre. At sunrise, seeing his fleet captured or sunk, Saladin launched an assault on the landward walls, thinking the defenders still distracted by the battle at sea. Conrad led his men in a sally, taking the enemy by surprise and breaking the Egyptian ranks. Saladin was forced to retreat, first setting fire to his siege engines to prevent them from falling into Christian hands. On that day, Saladin made an oath to take vengeance upon the infidel prince. Conrad was a fearsome and cunning general, and he led his army to recapture many of the territories taken by Saladin. Their aim was to retake the holy city of Jerusalem, which Saladin had reclaimed for the faithful years before. Jerusalem, it should be noted, is as revered by the infidels as it is by the faithful. For the prophet Isa, whom the Christians falsely believe to be a god, is said to have been crucified in that city. Returning to his tent after dining with his companions, Conrad was attacked by two assassin soldiers, who stabbed him to death with many dagger blows. Though the prince's guards killed one of the attackers, the other slipped into the night. By chance, he was captured. Under the most exquisite tortures, the surviving assassin claimed that another Christian prince, named Richard, was behind the slaying of Conrad. Whether or not this claim be true, or whether the soldier was lying in order not to betray his imam, we cannot know. And yet, a rumour spread amongst Muslims and Christians alike, that this Richard, who is known to some as the Lion-Hearted, had indeed ordered the murder of his sworn brother, Conrad. Shortly before his death, Conrad had been proclaimed King of Jerusalem by his fellow Christian princes, and this had aroused the jealousies of Richard, who coveted that title. Moreover, Conrad was engaged in secret talks with Saladin. A successful alliance between Conrad and the Sultan might weaken the designs of Richard to lead the Christians. On the other hand, such an alliance might free the hand of Saladin, allowing him to strike against the assassin fortresses in Syria. A rumour spread amongst the infidels that Sinan wrote a letter to a Christian prince taking credit for the order to kill Conrad. However, wiser men, who can recognise such Christian trickery, dismissed this letter as a forgery. The truth of the death of Conrad remains shrouded in mystery. The knowledge of these events is possessed only by the assassins, the angels, and God. Marco Polo puts down the book. The candles in his room have burned down to the base and gone out. The sun is rising over the Bosphorus. I should write a book, I think, for I have met men as cunning and dangerous as this Rashid Sinan, and I have seen places just as remarkable as the pleasure gardens of Alamut. And though I have not seen that remarkable fortress, yet, in a way, I have. For, as the bookseller said, through literature we can experience the whole world. So I think I might just include the tale of the Old Man of the Mountain in my own book. Thinking about that, the great explorer flopped down on his bed and quickly fell asleep, to dream of Xanadu and all the riches of the Orient. Thank you for listening to this special 100th episode of Assassinations Podcast. The subject of the episode was suggested by our friends at History by Hollywood Podcast. Thanks, guys. Good call. This was a work of historical fiction, and it was tremendous fun to write. I hope you enjoyed it, too. We'll be back next month with a brand new investigation looking at the Canadian engineer Gerald Boulle, the inventor of a long-range artillery piece dubbed the Supergun. He was allegedly assassinated by Israel's Mossad intelligence agency in 1990. I hope you'll join me for that. Until then, goodbye.